Well, hello everyone, and welcome to these thoughts regarding the fate of Ukraine. I want to put it out there that as of me streaming this, most people are focusing on the situation regarding the Trump White House. And I want to put it out there that I personally find it sickening, nay, morally repulsive, that this conflict, which has caused the death of tens of thousands of people, has been reduced in its last stages, ostensibly according to many people who do believe that either victory or peace is on the horizon, that it has essentially been reduced to the mundanity and banality of a reality TV show, which is very much Trump's style. And for that reason, I'm not thinking about Trump. I'm even thinking less about Putin. I am talking about the futility of peace in Ukraine as a Ukrainian memento mori, the inevitability of death. I want this stream to be focused on Ukraine and not focused on the external actors that are trying to affect an outcome in Ukraine. Inevitably, I'll have to talk to them, but my focus is not centered on them. And that is a way of really making this stream, I hope, distinct from so much of the commentary that is spewing forth. And I want to begin again, rather differently, by reciting a section from a poem. It is a poem by Lord Byron in the early 19th century, a poem regarding one Ivan Mazepa. Since I became the Cossack's guest, they found me senseless on the plain. They bore me to the nearest hut. They brought me into life again, me one day o'er their realm to reign. Thus the vain fool who strove to glut his rage refining on my pain sent me forth to the wilderness bound, naked, bleeding, and alone, to pass the desert to a throne. What mortal his own doom may guess, let none despond, let none despair. Tomorrow the Borisephanes may see our courses graze at ease upon his Turkish bank, and never had I such welcome for a river as I shall yield when safely there. Comrades, good night. The hetman threw his length beneath the oak tree shade, with leafy couch already made, a bed nor comfortless nor new to him who took his rest whenever the hour arrived, no matter where his eyes, the hastening slumbers steep. Ivan Mazepa was a famous Cossack and retroactively considered a famous Ukrainian prince, who fought at the time against Peter the Great, the Tsar of Russia, during the Great Northern War. It should be quite prescient to those looking at comparisons with what's happening today that Ivan Mazepa's rebellion was sponsored and supported by one famous king of the West, King Charles XII, Carolus Rex. Indeed, if you look at the fate of Poltava, the examples of trying to dismember Russia by tearing apart her vassals, it's eerie. Indeed, it's a comment I've made on other streams regarding the policy of Carolus Rex, King of Sweden, as an early example of regime change in Russia, or an attempted and ultimately futile extent. But there's another element to here, which is Mazepa being invited as the Cossack's guest to become king, the man who would be king, the man who would try to tame this wild realm of the wild fields of Zaporozhye, the borderlands, the Ukraina, the land between the other realms, try to carve out his own kingdom, and indeed do so with the support of Western leaders, in particular the King of Sweden. All of this should be obvious in terms of a comparison for people listening, but there's another point to mention, which is again the futility of the rage refining on my pain, striving as a vain fool to establish a kingdom. It's the idea almost of an oxymoron of that of a Ukrainian kingdom having ever existed or the potentiality for it ever to exist. And against this, I want to, I would say, regale a fantasy to you, which is a fantasy of what Ukraine ought to be. If we look at the etymological and historical roots of Ukraine, if we really focus on this idea of a borderland, on the potentiality of Ukraine in the post-Soviet settlement when it ceased to become a Soviet republic. The whole notion of a borderland, in the case of today, the borderlands between the Balkans, Eastern Europe, and Russia, it lends itself to a federal structure. Ukraine is an amalgamation of cultures and of peoples, from the Rusyns and the Hungarians in the west to the Russians in the east, to the hodgepodge of nationalities that you see in Bessarabia. Indeed, if you also include the Polish-influenced areas and the Austrian-influenced areas in the west versus the more Russified areas in the east, and indeed the lingering elements of Turkish and Cossack influence, which is more poignant when you included Crimea as formerly part of Ukraine until it was annexed by Russia in 2014. This whole notion that Ukraine is really a nation between nations and in itself an anti-nation. It is a space. It is the Pontic steppe. It is the void. It lends itself to this idea, like I said, of a federal structure, all of these elements being included and represented. This is also referenced in terms of the very religious makeup of Ukraine. Ukraine, on the one hand, is a bastion of orthodoxy. Indeed, from my point of view, it's clear to see that the development of Russian orthodoxy, especially if we look at the old believers in Alexis in the 17th century, again, this is going to sound completely out there for most people listening who are only familiar with what counts as commentary on Ukrainian history, that Kiev has influenced Moscow and vice versa, that there is a bit of to and fro regarding the makeup of the whole Orthodox community, the Eastern Orthodox Church in Ukraine, which is all the more tragic when you look at the recent schism. But then against that, you also have the influence of the Uniate Church, the Slavonic Rite Catholics, and indeed of Latin Rite Catholics themselves. All of these commingling influences, again, they are a demonstration, or were at least, the fact that history of Ukraine is an oxymoron if one looks at it as a nation-centered history. It is the diversity of all of these different influences commingling together into a new construct for a nation-state. What is the closest then that we have towards a whole idea of peace for this? The ironic thing is it was actually sponsored by Russia in the Eternal Peace of 1686, which I would comment as one of the great triumphs of European diplomacy. And it was orchestrated under a figure which most people have now forgotten because she forms part of the backstory of Tsar Peter the Great, who has overshadowed her legacy, which was the great sovereign Sophia, his elder half-sister. But nevertheless, the Eternal Peace was able to rectify, you can say, centuries of horrific animosity between the Poles and the Russians. The Poles, just for example, had been fighting a war with Russia on and off since the height of Ivan the Great and the Livonian Wars. They had occupied Moscow. The Romanov dynasty had been forged in opposition to that following the liberation of Moscow in, what was it, the year 1613. Of course, 200 years later, we have the example of the Great Patriotic War to come as a further comparison to that. But the remarkable thing about this Eternal Peace Treaty is that you have these two hostile elements who are both ethnically, religiously, and culturally completely opposed to one another. And yet they are able to form some iteration of a peace which lasts until the partitions of Poland, the very cynical partitions of Poland from 1772 onwards, up until the dissolution of Poland as a state in 1795. If there is a peace between two such opposed elements, it was demonstrated in 1686. Of course, this wasn't demonstrated in terms of the creation of a Ukrainian identity. What Ukraine was separated between these two peaceful entities. When we talk about the left bank and the right bank Ukraine, the areas under Russian occupation, the areas in which the Cossacks had basically sworn allegiance following the Treaty of Pereyaslav, or indeed, according to some interpretations of that treaty, where the Russians under Tsar Alexis had decided essentially to recognize the idea of a primordial, or you can say embryonic Ukrainian state in the form of the Cossack Hetmanate of Khmelnytsky, which again contrasts the idea of Ivan Mazepa, which I brought earlier. All of this is to say that all of these elements, like I said, commingling together, this idea of peace in Ukraine, it is held again to this idea that Ukraine is one of the most heterogeneous states in Europe. Indeed, you can almost say the world. What defines Ukraine in contrast to so many of the other states in Europe is its heterogeneity, the fact that its borders are, as a result of great power contrivance, not to say that's not the case of every border in terms of European nations, but in the case of Ukraine, no one is really satisfied with its borders. If you're a Ukrainian nationalist, it's not simply a matter of not tolerating truncation of your territory, but you want to expand Ukraine up to the natural boundaries of the Don, or perhaps even further to the River Volga or the Caucasus. And of course, if you're a Russian nationalist, as we're seeing, trying to sunder the four oblasts from the remnants of Ukrainian territory, having already taken Crimea. So that is one element here, which I bring essentially to the idea, the dream, of what is represented by Ukraine. And in terms of what that could really represent in a post-Soviet settlement during the unipolar moment, is it could have acted as a bridge, not just a borderland, but a gateway from which to integrate the cultures of Russia and the cultures of Europe. Essentially, Ukraine would be a conduit for what represents the best of those civilizational elements, and could form as a way essentially of bridging the two identities through a Ukrainian federal identity. But moving on from the dream and to the reality, that was not the way Ukraine was construed by certain policymakers in the West. Ukraine has instead been construed as an icebreaker against Russian nationality. If you look at the whole Soviet historiography of Ukraine, trying to justify Ukrainian membership of the Soviet Union, with its borders having essentially been established by Lenin in 1922 following the civil war against the whites. The whole notion of Ukrainian identity was vested in this idea that there was a pan-Slavic element which was recurring throughout East Slavic history. And again, if you're going to compare this to somewhere like Croatia, rather ironically, a huge amount of intellectual development in the 19th century focuses on the unity between the peoples of Ukraine and the peoples of Russia, what were then termed the Little Russians and the Greater Russians, this whole notion of Pan-Slavism. While Pan-Slavism was actually such a threat to the Russian Tsar, is that there was a democratic basis to it, which instead was found in the Ukrainian fetishization of the life of the Cossack. There was a democratic identity to be wedded here. And again, this is to emphasize that there is a large strain of Ukrainian national thought, which is wedded instead to this idea of Pan-Slavism, to be wedded to be part of this greater whole. In a sense, you can say that this Ukraine would follow in the impetus of the French Revolution, that is a matter essentially of forming a democratic state from these elements within the Russian Empire. And indeed, conversely, it was also used by Tsar Nicholas II as a justification for Little Russian expansion at the expense of the Austrian Empire. So it's rather ironic that I take this element of the intellectual development of Pan-Slavism within Ukraine, which again is another element which Putin, and like I said, the Soviet historiography essentially explains as representing this historic fraternity between the nations. Little Ukraine, or Little Russia or Ukraine, is effectively supposed to represent the eldest brother to Russia. It essentially is the second member of this great pursuit of socialism in one country. So against that, against, you can say, the hagiography which alludes to certain influences towards Russia, that Ukraine is inevitably part of the Russian patrimony and not part of the Western patrimony, which I've just outlined there, we have the view placed in contradistinction to that, which is Ukraine as the national icebreaker. If you look at the intellectual indebtedness of Pan-Slavism and you look at Ukraine, if you can somehow take Ukrainian nationality and you can sunder it completely from Russian nationality, then all of a sudden you have created the impetus for the dismemberment of Russian nationality in total. If Ukraine can be placed as a diametric opposite, as an antithesis of the existence of Russia, what Putin would consider to be his own perception of Nazification in the case of Ukraine, then it only follows that Russian nationality is incredibly precarious. And that, I believe, is part of the tragedy of Ukraine in this instance. I talk about the federal structure. I talk about Russia trying to reintegrate this notion of Ukrainian nationality through the veins of Pan-Slavism. And indeed, you can say the more anti-ethno-nationalist affiliations with Soviet communism, which again, Putin is very much a successor to. And then you have this idea of Ukraine as the icebreaker. Ironically, regarding how much Putin talks about Nazification, the Germans during World War II weren't really prepared to exploit the extent to which that principle of Ukrainian identity and nationality, used in contrast to a pan-Slavic Russian identity or Russo-dominated identity, could be used to dismember Russian nationality. So while you have the lionization of figures such as Stepan Bandera among certain facets of the Maidan movement, it's very clear that he was a marginalized figure within World War II. So again, the subtle contrast between these opinions. But my general point is, Ukraine, in this sense, you can almost say is analogous to Croatia in Yugoslavia. I do believe there's an argument to be presented that Croatia was essentially used as the cudgel, as the icebreaker from which members of the European Union and indeed the West were able to dismantle Yugoslavism. And that is very much happening in the case of Ukraine today and pan-Slavism. Indeed, there's another point which can be drawn here, which again, the subtle ironies to the socialist government of Slobodan Milosevic looking at the checkerboard flag of Franjo Tuđman and saying that this was a restitution of the Ustasha, of fascism, in the same way that Putin looks at the Azov battalion and sees this as the restoration of the Banderites, of Nazism. It's really rather remarkable to consider all of these sort of subtle permutations and influences. But like I said, I think there's an element here that despite, again, Ukraine having been in many senses the originator of intellectual pan-Slavism, as Croatia was in many ways the originator of intellectual Yugoslavism, that both of these nations should be held as some form of World War II analogous Nazi iteration to break both of these nations. But regardless, moving on from that, the effect of the war, regardless of whatever identity is being forced upon Ukraine, whether it be this Russophobic identity or this Russophilic identity, it should go without saying that Ukrainian identity, I would say, is undergoing a process of becoming a nation once again. That's a famous quote from Churchill regarding Ireland's potential participation in World War II. And what I believe Churchill is alluding to, even though Irish nationalists take it to mean something completely different, is that a nation once again alludes to what I believe to be the Australian experience in Gallipoli, which is that a nation is forged in the fires of conflict. In the case of the experience of Gallipoli for the Anzac nations, the military disaster was actually enough to form such a state of national consciousness that actually created a set of separation from the motherland, a separation from Britain, owing to the fact you can say that Churchill's doomed enterprise there had in many ways expended the forces of the Commonwealth in a futile endeavor. You can say actually that again is rather prescient if we understand Ukrainian identity as looking at the example of some form of 21st century Gallipoli, which ultimately is what it amounts to, a glorious idea of taking Constantinople or taking Moscow, which ends up to be a total military farce. So regardless of how the war turns out, regardless of how well Russia may be doing on the battlefield, I believe it's undeniable that if there was a Russophilic aspect to Ukrainian identity, the whole nature of war and the whole nature of these nations felling each other in the tens of thousands has inevitably led to, I would say, an irrevocable breach in identity. It's something which I believe is reoccurring throughout all of greater Rus history. By Rus, I include the Belarusians and the Ukrainians or the Little Russians, because it's something that separated those two patrimonies when we have the Mongol invasions in the 13th century. But those two nations essentially were separated by distance, and they were separated by the regimes ruling over them. In the case of modern Ukraine, this is direct. These are nations attacking each other, as opposed to simply being separated by historical circumstance, which I believe was responsible for the first breach in identity between the Ruthenians, the Latinized Russians, and the Rusia, the Eastern Russian under the state of Muscovy, to the point that you can say Muscovite identity is being used again as a way to differentiate Russia further from Ukraine. Ukraine is now the originator of the Kievan Rus. It is the state of Vladimir the Great, despite the fact that Zelensky, ironically, is Volodymyr and Putin is Vladimir. They both share the name with the namesake, the founder of both of the respective sort of mythologies of those patrimonies. They originate in the same place. They originate in Kiev around the 10th century. All of a sudden, to the Ukrainian nationality, Russia has become Muscovy. It has become the Golden Horde. It has become the arch vassal of the Mongol Empire. In the same way that if we look at Ukrainian identity, you can say there's an aspect of it under the Banderite ideology, which is being de-Slavicized, the idea to emphasize other historical roots, whether it even be Gothic identity or Sarmatian identity. Such, you can say, nationalist perversions and mythologies are recurrent throughout all of history, but such has become very in vogue, and you can indeed, you can say, from the point of view of national myth-making, it has become a necessity. So regardless of what you can basically say as the idea of peace in Ukraine, it is an indelible fact now that having explained the fantasy of Ukraine, and having basically explained, you can say, the futility of Ivan Mazepa, you can say the ancient example of a original Zelensky, of coming through and trying to form a nation out of all of these pluralistic elements in the wild fields, which represents the borderlands between these societies. All of a sudden now, I believe you have an irrevocable breach between these two identities. And this is also confirmed when you look at the whole nature of Zelensky's war state. I don't believe that Zelensky's regime... Sorry, I'm going to mention someone in the chat. This sounds like Putin's wet dream. Well done. I am not taking a Russian, a Russian-centered view. I'm talking about the ancient history of a potential federal Ukraine. I'm saying the Russophobic attitude looks at Ukraine as a icebreaker against Russian nationality, and the Russophilic identity sees Ukraine indelibly as part of the same patrimony. I'm saying both views are held in distinction. I'm saying Ukraine doesn't necessarily need to be part of it, but I'm saying once these views are breached, essentially, then Ukraine turns into a perpetual war zone. The borderlands effectively becomes what it has been from the 17th century, where you had the Crimean Khanate and you had Tatars prowling over the territory and capturing Christian slaves in the droves. And I look at somewhere like the Eternal Peace Treaty. Like I said, it's the great aberration. And of course, was punctuated with that a great attempt of Ivan Mazepa to establish his Ukrainian kingdom during the Great Northern War. So what I'm basically saying here is that Putin's dream is not Putin's wet dream, it's Putin's nightmare. And I also encourage more people to, you know, send me questions in the chat, because this is only going to be a, you know, relatively short stream. But it's important to understand here that Ukrainian identity, going back to my Anzac comparison of becoming a nation once again, like I said, it severs this idea going back to Soviet historiography and Putin's own hagiography of Russian history, the idea of the little brother nation. You know, how can a little Russian identity survive, given the not just the onslaught between these two nations, but also the fact that there has been hysterical, concerted propaganda, which has been enacted on both parties within the West and within Russia? I don't believe one part is particularly helpful or one side is correct here. My objective analysis, my value-free analysis, is to say here that it is a fact that both these nations have been through these experiences, that these nations have been propagandized. And what we essentially arrived at is an antithesis between the remnants of Ukraine and the elements of Russia. If we look at the Russian elements that they're trying to sunder away and reincorporate into the patrimony of Russia, like the four oblasts, this again, like I said, is going to leave a rump of Ukraine, which is even more ferociously anti-Russian than had those areas been allowed to remain as part of Ukraine, because you are consolidating a nationality in Ukraine, which throws away this idea of borderlands and instead actually leans on the Western Polonized, and you can even say elements of Banderaite ideology, which infect the Maidan movement. All of this, again, is to say that this is the antithesis of what Putin wants. In some ways, I believe the West has succeeded. The West has succeeded in pitting these nations against each other. It has made a nonsense of the whole Russian historiography regarding the little nation of Ukraine as being one of the elder brothers of socialism. Or looking back, you can say, at the Panslavists in the 19th century, whether they be apologists for Imperial Russia or whether they be genuine advocates for democracy, as far as we can even construe of that term in 19th century Russia. Now I want to come to the practicality of Zelensky's war state. For better or worse, Zelensky has been able to accomplish something which is really an incredible feat, which is a effective police state under his own control, an effective police state that has subordinated many elements of the security services, the army, as incorporated elements of the Maidan movement, the radicals in the West, but has also effectively banned pro-Russian opposition. And it has also effectively banned the Russian Orthodox Church, as again being anti-Ukrainian in the sense this is all part of a great Russian subversion. This again goes against my idea earlier on as explaining the borderlands as inherently lending itself to a federal structure if Ukraine within those current boundaries is going to exist as a nation at all. And so how do you suddenly dislodge Zelensky's war state? And again, the irony, of course, of all of this, and someone's mentioning the Bandarist ideology and how this actually makes enemies of Poland as well. Yes, I'm going to bring that in again. The irony of all of this is that it actually makes regime change very, very difficult in Ukraine. It makes regime change very, very difficult in Ukraine because Zelensky has effectively neutered all opposition, not just in terms of the pro-Russian elements within Ukraine, but also you can say among those who would actually want to continue the war in perpetuity. You can even say, to a further extent, with a greater ferocity than that of Zelensky himself. The whole premise of the Ukrainian state now under Zelensky is that of the war state. The whole security state is perpetuated by this conflict. If Zelensky has to make peace, he then has to justify holding elections, elections which he fears he will lose. Thus, he has to basically hold his legitimacy together through presentation of selected polls, rather than going through a national polling system, i.e. through a national election. And that's essentially what the Russians want. And if the Americans want it too, I believe it'll be fundamentally destabilizing to Ukraine, because so much of the Ukrainian system is personally loyal to Zelensky as a result of the creation of Zelensky's war state. So I believe that any peace in the remnant of Ukraine will inevitably involve a destabilization of Ukraine. And that, of course, is what Russia wants. But let's get into really what Russia wants. If Russia wants destabilization, it wants weakness. It wants Ukraine to be a weak and supplicant state. And I think that's obvious. What does Russia really mean when it doesn't want Ukraine to join NATO? Well, this is neutrality by compulsion. What does it mean where Russia wants to denazify Ukrainian politics? It wants to have a pervading influence over what political parties and actors are allowed to operate within Ukraine. In other words, neutrality by compulsion is not neutrality at all. Denazification is on itself a mission to deprive Ukraine of its sovereignty. In the same way that Ukraine, sundering these elements, you can say, of its more Russified patrimony, attacking political opponents, suppressing the church, is again another element by which you can say democracy, such as it exists in Ukraine, is a farce. Instead, we have Ivan Mazepa in the form of Zelensky trying to carve out his kingdom and turning what ultimately should be a federal structure into Ukraine into a unitary monarchical state, a monarchical state which is held up with the support of Carolus Rex in the West until we have the example of Poltava. You can even say perhaps that the recent disaster in Kursk could be the equivalent of Zelensky's own Poltava, if we're going to look at Ivan Mazepa. So on the one hand, you can say you have the delusions of sovereignty being supported by NATO membership in the West, but you also have that similar delusion being pursued by the Russian policy of denazification in the East. Indeed, both visions are terrifying for Ukraine. One vision from the West is using Ukraine as a meat shield to force more and more and more conscripts to essentially be killed on the trenches against Russia. And then you have the Russian vision, which is of a weak, pliant destabilize Ukraine, which is effectively demilitarized. What is neutrality? Neutrality ought to be a natural expression of self-determination. Neutrality is a statement that I am not going to be compelled into a system of alliances. You can say that there are many nations that attempted to pursue this policy of neutrality during the interwar period. You can say, for example, the state of Denmark, Sweden. You can say one of the great successes of Sweden during that time is that it was able to effectively assert some form of net neutrality, which actually meant deference towards Germany in terms of its economics and its trading relationship by necessity. But if you look to the example of Belgium, what is neutrality really when we talk about greater powers surrounding a smaller power, i.e. NATO on the one hand and Russia on the other? Neutrality is a byproduct of compulsion. Compulsion and military strength. What was the scrap of paper? What was the Treaty of London which held neutrality in Belgium together? It was the agreement of France and of Germany, Prussia and of Great Britain not to invade that country. In other words, if one nation feels it's stronger than the others, it can basically violate that neutrality and make that neutrality a nonsense, which is what the Germans felt that they could effectively achieve when they invaded Belgium in 1914. So in other words, the whole notion of neutrality in Ukraine, should the Russians be able to achieve it, i.e. eternal non-membership of NATO, can only be sustained by the constant preparation of a future conflict with NATO. That is inevitable. If ever Russia is seen to be weak, like it was in the 1990s, then neutrality all of a sudden becomes a nonsense. This is neutrality which is enforced at the end, at the point of a sword. Russia must effectively have a force ready to invade Ukraine, as we see with the special military operation, at any time, should it feel that Ukraine has been pulled over into the Western camp once again. In other words, like I said, this is a recipe not for a lasting peace settlement. This is a recipe for perpetual conflict. But now let's look at the logic of Russian expansionism. Already that we have seen Crimea has been taken over by Russia and they have annexed the four oblasts, even though they have failed to remove Ukrainian troops from those territories. Assuming they do, the logic of Russian expansionism really shouldn't stop at the four oblasts. So we're looking at this from a geostrategic point of view. You have the Russian enclave next to Moldova in the Transnistria. Indeed, Russia has a lot of influences regarding Moldova and a lot of historical ties there. You can say the only reason Moldova exists as a country is because Russia tore it away from Romania. If Moldova were to become fully integrated into the West, it should by extension become fully integrated into Romania, which perhaps they can do now. Kalinescu has been barred from election in Romania. Perhaps that's the next step. But somehow I doubt it's going to come out like that. But nevertheless, it'll be an interesting example of defying Russia's historical legacy by reincorporating Moldova back into Romania. But someone is mentioning in the chat about the natural boundary of the Dnieper. No, Russia needs to go further than that. Russia would need to annex Bessarabia. Russia would need to annex Odessa. Both of these elements have huge amount of historical, ethnic and strategic implications for Russia. We're going to integrate these territories. Indeed, so long as Ukraine holds Odessa, Ukraine will always be a threat to Russia's dominance over the Black Sea, especially if we see there's going to be a process, you can say, of arming up Romania and establishing a NATO Black Sea presence in Romania as well, in addition to the Black Sea coast that we already see with Turkey. In other words, Russia really shouldn't stop at the four oblasts. So we're talking about maximalism. You know, so many Western commentators talk about Putin's maximalist demands. No, the maximalist demands are to take Odessa and to establish Russian boundaries, taking over places like Kharkov and in other areas, expanding Russian influence to that of the Dnieper River as one boundary, but also taking over all of Ukraine's military bases, naval bases in the Black Sea would be another element to it. But that again, like I said, the smaller Ukraine becomes, the more Western it becomes, the more vitriolic and completely opposed to Russia the remnant Ukraine becomes, because the Russo Philic aspects of Ukraine, the Russian patrimony of Ukraine, are taken away, and what is left effectively are those elements of Ukrainian society, and indeed areas that have only recently been part of the Soviet patrimony, like Galicia or the Rusyn-Carpathian region. All of these elements are effectively to say that what is left then of Ukraine becomes ever more hostile to Russia, which will mean the imposition of neutrality on that territory becomes ever more difficult. So what then is the logic that would extend from there? Well, further expansion is not enough to take the four oblasts, is not enough to take Odessa, is not enough to take Bessarabia, is not enough to take the eastern Dnieper region, but you need to keep expanding. And ironically, the further you expand into, say, for example, Poland's sphere of influence in the case of Galicia, then the whole logic of the special military operation appears in reverse. In the same way that Ukraine becoming a part of NATO was seen as an existential threat to Russia, why shouldn't the European Union and NATO see Russian troops in Lviv or Lvov as an existential threat to Europe? Indeed, you can see a bizarre situation that as Russia keeps expanding into Ukraine, that NATO will end up invading Ukraine on its own volition. What then effectively becomes the future of Ukraine? If we see that Zelensky's war state will not collapse in and of itself, the whole basis of Zelensky's war state is based on the perpetuation of said conflict, because if Zelensky were to end the conflict, the whole regime could inevitably collapse, which would lead to destabilization, which will further lead to continued conflict. Well, assuming that we have two blows, effectively a partition like we saw during the Molotov-Ribbentrop Pact, except done with no sort of amicable settlement. This is very much done by both sides acting in an act of supreme hostility towards one another, attempting to prevent them carving out spheres of influence. Poland annexing Galicia and the areas of Ukraine that were formerly part of the East Polish patrimony, or the Kresy, during the Second Polish Republic, which ended in 1939 with the partition of the Molotov-Ribbentrop Pact. And then you have the rest, which is occupied or basically a vassal for Russia. Then effectively all you have is the North Korean scenario. You have two hostile states facing off against each other, and perhaps a demilitarized zone, perhaps at Kiev, or perhaps a little bit to the west of Kiev, separating these territories. The reason, again, I bring this up is that very few people I've seen commenting are really going at length to explain the logistics of what neutrality, non-membership of NATO, really entails. The fact that Russian demands of non-NATO membership become more unreasonable the more truncated Ukraine becomes, the less territory effectively it's able to operate effective control over, because by extension, Ukraine then becomes more fanatical in its opposition to Russia. And again, I go back to the tragedy. I go back to the fantasy I brought up at the beginning of the ideal post-Soviet settlement for Ukraine, that of it really emblemizing, going with the idea of the borderlands, the federal structure, bringing the best of Russian civilization and European civilization together, bringing all of these cultural and religious connections, which again make Ukraine, like I said, one of the most heterogeneous states, historically heterogeneous states. I don't mean that in the sense of diversity is our strength. Please disabuse yourselves of any notion if I'm trying to make some sort of equivocacy here. But I mean heterogeneous in the sense that these territories were historically divided between great empires, warring empires. Hence, Ukraine is therefore an incredibly apt etymology for the state, the borderlands between these two empires. But what I think Russia views the history of Ukraine as is a version of the Morgenthau Plan. Destabilized and effectively deindustrialized, demilitarized, whereas the Western view of Ukraine is highly militarized, the icebreaker on Russia's border. If it can sunder Ukrainian nationality away from Russia, it can be used as the breach point, the bridgehead from which Russia could be dismembered as a nation. Because ironically, Putin is earnestly appealing to a Soviet-era mantra, a Tsarist-era mantra of the integration of Russia's peoples It is not a Russian nation state in the sense that it is an ethno-state. It is why, say, for example, when I brought up the example of Croatia earlier and Slobodan Milosevic, that is imperfect, and why I believe that Putin has only very blatantly resorted to what you can say a revanchist, irredentist political strategy of reattaching Russian speakers into Russia proper, is because Putin is not an ethno-nationalist. He believes that having a distinct policy based on the reincorporation of Russian people back into Russia lends itself to this idea that Russia is an ethno-state. Indeed, the more Russians see themselves as distinct from all other peoples within the Russian Federation, that in itself destabilizes the Russian Federation, because the Russian Federation is a hodgepodge of vast national groups, from the Tatars to the Kalmucks to the Siberian peoples, etc., to the Karelians, to the Ugric peoples, etc., 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 to the Chechens. The list goes on and on and on. So, from my point of view, considering all of these elements, I don't believe that peace in Ukraine is possible. That's not to say that there may be some ceasefire at some point, but any settlement that could be achieved by the Trump administration, I believe, will be fleeting, in the same way that we saw the original Minsk agreements were fleeting. The Europeans were clearly using them to buy time. Do you honestly believe, if there was a concession made for the neutrality of Ukraine, that the United States won't try and do this again? Europe has predicated essentially its existence in terms of a defense state, the ever sort of furthering integration of Europe, based on the fates of Ukraine. For Europe, Ukraine is an imperial project. Ukraine was supposed to be the great breadbasket of Europe. You can almost say reviving the idea of the Reichskommissariat Ukraine, back during World War II. All of these elements are again to suggest that the element of completely hostile strategy directed against Russia has not gone away. And it won't go away. Indeed, I believe that the Eurocrats have placed themselves in this position where they can't drop Ukraine. They have invested their entire political capital on the perpetuation of the war in Ukraine. So even if there is a ceasefire in Ukraine, it's going to be, as Winston Churchill essentially described, the peace at Versailles. It is going to be a ceasefire for 20 years. Even though I believe Churchill actually had far less grounds for saying that regarding the end of World War I than I do regarding the fate of Ukraine. Indeed, if we're going to look to examples of World War I, I've already brought up the example of neutrality predicated on strength with regards to Belgium. But what America is doing now is going to be easily construed as a stab in the back theory. As the Germans did in 1919, the Ukrainian mythology is going to be that Ukraine was fighting against Russia and was at the point of victory until the Americans decided to betray the cause of Ukraine. That, together with my Gallipoli analogy, I believe will be enough to sustain any Ukrainian government in a sense of hostility towards Russia. Indeed, the more territories it'll lose, the more the remnant rump state of Ukraine will be united around this idea of restoring those territories. And like I said, for the Ukrainian nationalists, it's not enough simply to restore these territories or to even restore Crimea. It's a matter of expanding Ukraine's boundaries to the Volga, to the Caucasus, and you can say more realistically to the Don River. In other words, Ukraine must be strong to the extent that Russia can never imperil its existence ever again. So there we are. And like I said, with the whole Trump thing, I really just think it really does frustrate me, because I really do think it's a distraction. And also, I don't trust in the sincerity of Trump and his belief in peace. I think Trump is looking at Ukraine as a temporary liability in terms of US foreign policy. In other words, in terms of America's economic position and in terms of any showdown with China, having such hysterically hostile views towards Russia is a liability. And thus, I believe what Trump is aiming for is normalization. Peace is simply an extension of that normalization process towards relations with Russia. But like I said, with the whole notion of Ukrainian neutrality being a nonsense, because neutrality, if it's not an emanation of self-determination, neutrality is imposed. The West and the European Union will be consolidating to mobilize its resources to effectively achieve, like the French did in World War I, the restitution of Alsace and Lorraine, the restitution of the four oblasts that were sundered away. So like I said, there is no situation in which I see an amicable settlement. If the Russians are still holding to this idea, their hagiography of history, where the Ukrainians are the little Russians, the Ukrainians are the elder brother of socialism in the case of the Soviet Union, then they are fantasists, because this project isn't going to go away. How are the Russians going to enforce this? Expelling all NGOs, banning political parties. In other words, they would have to do what Zelensky did, but in reverse. And of course, imposing this on a foreign country. And as we see, even with the example of tariffs in Canada today, the fact that these will be seen direct foreign impositions will indeed embolden any resistance against Russia, making the whole process of denazification, like I said, a fundamental attack on sovereignty, which will embolden a sense of Ukrainian particularism. All right. It was only going to be 45 minutes, but I really needed to get this out. Because, you know, someone is saying, I thought Russians were good at chess. Putin, like I said, regarding his belated Milosevicism, sorry if I make all of these ad hoc sort of verbal combinations as I'm sort of going along, but it helps me sort of be able to articulate these points as to why, say, for example, Putin was so reluctant to pursue a policy of the reincorporation of ethnic Russians. The reason, again, I emphasize all of this, is to say that Putin really doesn't think in these terms naturally. He doesn't think in terms of looking at Russia as a nation of all Russian citizens. This isn't a home in the Reich. This isn't Hyman's Reich, if we're going to look to an ideology for National Socialist Germany. What Putin is effectively looking at is a system of security and diplomatic relations. You know, he has a strong enough sense of history where he can buttress that view with a perception that Ukraine ought to be historically inclined and favorable towards Russian civilization. Indeed, that's his whole perception of Ukraine. He cannot see a Ukrainian nationality which is fundamentally opposed to Russia. And indeed, you can say the futility of being able to extend that view, which I believe is very much now, that is a historical view. It is not a statement of present fact, which I think is all the more remarkable. You know, I can look at history and I can feel a sense of nostalgia. I can look to all of these historical precedents and see things you can perhaps see in an idealized form, things as they ought to be. And yet in the case of Putin, I believe this is actually nothing more than a strain on his view. I believe it's part of a departure of reality now to see that Ukraine can be restored to its position as we saw during the Soviet Union, where Ukraine was a willing member of it. And that is because Ukraine had a lot of purchase in the Soviet system. What purchase would Ukraine have with a relationship with Russia, where Russia has a vested interest in keeping Ukraine weak and destabilized? Again, is a point of resentment. In the same way that Ukrainians look to the early Soviet history, they look to the Holodomor, and they look perhaps to the experience of the White Revolution in Russia during the Civil War, and they see it as a point of contradistinction. It took decades, really during the Khrushchev era, for there to be this, you can say, I wouldn't say organic, but definitely a process of political purchase and integration. And that was demonstrated when, with the 300th anniversary of the Treaty of Pereyaslav, Khrushchev decided to award Ukraine with the territory of Crimea to elevate Ukraine's position within the whole nexus of the Union of Soviet Socialist Republics. So when I talk about the futility of peace, I want people to recognize that peace is not on the horizon. There is not going to be a situation where Trump and Zelensky and Putin sit down and they write the world, effectively. You know, Trump, I doubt, will win the Nobel Peace Prize for a variety of reasons, most of which are political, nothing to do with the situation. But it wouldn't be a true demonstration of having achieved peace in Ukraine. Indeed, as we saw, Obama's own Nobel Peace Prize was a bit of a nonsense. But anyway, I'm losing my voice after my rant, but I hope that people can understand a bit more about the context of the actual implications regarding the nationalities and how they perceive the conflict in Ukraine, and how we are so far removed from the fantasy I alluded to at the beginning, where we look at the borderlands, the idyllic borderlands with its federal structure, with one foot in Europe and one foot in the Russian world. And then I come again back to the folly of Ivan Mazepa trying to carve out his unitary state, his kingdom in Ukraine, with Western support, and ultimately having amounted to nothing. You know, the great coalescing of Ukrainian identity under a strong militarized state, which will basically act as the vanguard of whatever European affront there is going to be Russia, that idea is dead. But the alternative for Ukraine is not much better. Anyway, I am going to go through the super chats. TL for $5. Love Nagubu, love AM, simple as. I don't understand what that means, TL, but thank you. Bass Kicker 14 for $5. How could Russia ever take any peace terms with the West? Exactly. Like I said, neutrality and agreeing not to become member of NATO, it's like it's compulsion. It relies purely on the relative balance of power. You know, maybe that's a good thing in the sense that European power politics is now going back to a recognition of what it always has been, which is the balance of power. That peace can only be assured effectively by militarized societies of rough parity. You know, if there's going to be any basis for a Ukrainian neutrality into perpetuity, it is the restitution of this old idea of the balance of power. But do you really think the European Union is invested in abandoning their rules-based international order for assuming a more realpolitik mantra of the balance of power? I don't think so. But again, if they don't acknowledge the idea or the necessity of the balance of power in terms of maintaining peace, then like we saw with so many other conflicts that I've alluded to, it simply becomes a matter of buying time, coalescing resources, and building up Ukraine, which is why Russia shouldn't accept a peace in terms of its own national interests, why the logic of Russian expansionism is to keep going further. Because they have the momentum now. If they surrender that momentum, they're effectively allowing for Ukraine to coalesce, like I said, into this hostile, truncated state, which is united around revanchism, the restitution of these territories. Which I do also believe was why Zelensky was able to come to power in the first place. You know, the restitution of Crimea, the restitution of Donetsk, the restitution of Luhansk. But imagine that on a much larger scale. Redacted Brainwaves for $5, thank you. It seems to me all futures proposed to Ukraine at the moment are unsustainable in the long term. How to solve the Ukrainian question? Well, I presented my solution to the Ukrainian question, but it's a fantasy. It's anti-historical. You know, I don't live in a realm of pure abstraction. I live in the world where I have these idealistic propositions which always reference to the actual situation on the ground. You know, there could have been a situation in the post-Soviet world in the unipolar moment where Ukraine could have represented that. But of course, Russia and the West are not benevolent entities in order to actually allow for that to come to fruition. That would be the ideal state, a federal structure, which ironically would also mean Russia abandoning its territorial designs on Ukraine. Like I said, for Putin, who doesn't think like a Milosevic, reincorporating the Russian patrimony is in many senses a form of ideological and political defeat for him, because it weakens the Ukrainian case to be part of the Russosphere. I hope this isn't too complicated for people to understand. Austin for $5, thank you. My thoughts about the whole eventual peace are Poland will take Galicia, Hungary will take the Carpathia region, and Russia will take the... Well, that's the logic. The logic, Austin, is that the territorial designs of the nations that surround Ukraine effectively lend itself to this logic of partition. And you're correct in saying that the natural partition of those territories would be Galicia and the area north of Galicia being returned to Poland, i.e. the restitution of the old Second Polish Republic border, and, as you mentioned, the Carpathian region returned to Hungary. Indeed, it's actually possible that whilst the Polish annexation of Galicia will be in complete opposition to Russia, that Hungary and Russia will come to some sort of arrangement when it comes to restitution of these regions, because Orban and Putin get on relatively well, And Putin has referenced it many times regarding the Hungarian case for self-determination within Ukraine. You think Georgescu is against Moldova being under Romanian influence? If he is a Romanian conservative, why would he be pro-Russian again? No, you misunderstand my point, Keiku, for I don't know what currency that is. No, you misunderestimate my point. Of course he would support, as we saw with his example of Ion Antonescu, of the greater patrimony of Romania, reincorporating elements of, say, not just Moldova, but the Ukrainian Bessarabia and Bukovina into Romania. That's not my point. My point is that it also serves the interests of the European Union as well, because Moldova, its very existence, is a legacy of the Soviet annexation of Bessarabia in 1940. What better way to undo Soviet, and then by extension, Russian history, than by reincorporating Moldova back into Romania and restoring the boundaries of Romania as they were during the interwar period? And ironically, Romania, during the interwar period, was the bastion of the Balkan League. It was one of the few states that I believe, I don't know if it ever recognized the Soviet Union, throughout, especially during the 1920s and 1930s. I'll have to verify that one way or the other. But again, Fortress Romania with enlarged patrimony, there is a logic there in terms of reincorporating Moldova, eliminating that vestige of Russian influence, and of course, placing the Russian population in Transnistria in a state of existential peril. You have Bresla. I assume that's Greek currency, so thank you very much, 30 of those. Austin for $5, thank you. A ceasefire will only give time for Ukraine to rearm itself. Russia will never agree to, yes, I've said that ad nauseum, and I agree with you. Austin again for $2, empires rising from the ashes. Russia is clearly an empire. Or you can say in more innocuous terms, Russia is a civilization state, which is a term that's also been described for China. But I would also refer to India as a civilization state and not a nation state. But Russia clearly is. It's a civilization. It is not a nation. And it is always, throughout its entire history, it has always pushed back against this idea of Russia being a pure ethnic democracy. That wasn't the case under the Tsars, and it wasn't the case under the Soviet Union. And it certainly isn't the case in the mind of Putin, who is the legacy of the Soviets. Like I said, Pan-Slavism is a countervailing ideology in many senses. It's why Putin, I don't believe, thoroughly embraces it. He adopts something quite different. As for Europe, I'm more skeptical. The Gunslinger for $5. Is Ukraine a sideshow for the real showdown with China, or is it a stop in a future global conflict with all the current players? Well, like I said, I think Trump clearly sees China as the bigger threat, and he's correct in many ways. Russia is and Ukraine is a bigger concern for Europe, but from Trump's point of view, China is clearly the main adversary, not just in terms of China threatening American interests in the Asia Pacific, but also China being more of an economic threat towards America. In which case, like I said, you have to remember the Russians are aware of this. Putin has been in charge of Russia since 1999. In other words, there's been some continuity of government, whereas the United States has elements of continuity, but it's punctuated by what you can say to be random moments of complete and utter contradiction, like Biden and Trump. But you can say ultimately the US strategy is the same. It doesn't want a strong Russia. It doesn't want a strong Europe. And so it makes sense to say, okay, we've lost in Ukraine. Let's rededicate our forces to a more worthwhile proposition, like facing off China. But that in no way ensures peace in Ukraine. Like I said, Putin has been shown again and again that ceasefires and peace settlements in Ukraine are basically temporary pauses in a long conflict, which, like I said again, it sustains Ukraine in this form of hostility towards Russia, which is why the logic of Russian expansionism is to the borders of 1939, not to the borders it is currently laid claim to. The Gunslinger again for $2, thank you. Is Ukraine the chess piece that starts World War III? As of now, I don't think so. Redacted brainwaves for $5. Won't Russification of Ukraine be inevitable given the demographic impact of the conflict? By demographic impact of the conflict, you mean how many Ukrainians have been killed? Russification of Ukraine will only work if Ukraine is dismembered as a state, like I said. If Ukraine is occupied by Russia up to the borders of Poland in 1939, and if it takes over Ukrainian Bessarabia, and it takes over Odessa, and it partitions the remaining territory, then the logic would be a protracted process of Russification. And that will be the process of denazification. Like I said, the logic of Russian expansionism and the full implications of neutrality and denazifying Ukraine inevitably mean Russian patrimony and Russian propaganda, and Russia having an influence in the preservation of the Russian language, over education, and invariably over institutions within Ukraine that are pro-Russian. The Bosman for $20. The day an Anglosphere nation or a liberal democracy is an honest actor of the day hell freezes. There is no such thing as an honest actor in terms of foreign policy. What distinguishes a liberal democracy from somewhere like Russia is that a liberal democracy pretends otherwise. That's basically it. A liberal democracy is a state effectively predicated on a lie, that it has transcended the nitty-gritty of realpolitik, when in reality it has not at all. But like I said, there are no innocents in the field of foreign policy. Jack Walters for $5. What do you think will happen in Europolitics when Ukraine inevitably loses, given how much they hit to Ukraine? Well, like I said, it seems that the Eurocrats have invested so much of their political capital in supporting Ukraine that the logic, and despising Russia, that the logic of their rhetoric and the political direction of Europe will effectively mean a perpetual conflict with Russia, which will lend itself to a North Korea type scenario. And like I said, if a North Korea type scenario is on the cards, then again, it serves Russia's interest to expand as far west as possible. If you're going to have a massively militarized demarcation zone between the West and the East, wouldn't it make much more sense for Russia to push it as far west as possible? Because again, you also have the question of Belarus. You know, if Belarus flips again, that is another, you know, mortal threat towards Russia. In the same way that Kazakhstan flipping, which is a distinct possibility, would be a mortal threat to Russia. You know, Putin has every interest in expanding those borders. What I believe is the main thing restraining that impulse from Putin is the fact that he's pursuing two policies at the same time, which is BRICS and Ukraine. And invariably, any nakedly expansionist aims which go, you can say, beyond the pale, like annexing or vassalizing non-Russian peoples, will be seen essentially as a, I wouldn't necessarily say an affront, but a diplomatic liability to those who is trying to suck up to, in terms of his pursuit of a alternative rules-based international order. Again, I'm using this all very cynically. Right. Any interesting questions before I get out of here? Everything would be fine if we just reestablished the Polish-Lithuanian Commonwealth. Well, the boundaries of the Polish-Lithuanian Commonwealth include a lot of Belarus as well. So you're asking for another conflict if you want to reintegrate that again. But like I said, bizarrely, there was a precedent for peace, which is when I go back to my example at the beginning of the Eternal Peace Treaty of 1686. There was an example of peace, and it seemed peace against all the odds, because there were so many things which pitted Russia against Poland. And indeed, it took a regime change in Poland and a military conquest by Sweden in order to be able to effectively temporarily undo the effects of the Eternal Peace Treaty. But bear in mind, as with all things, you know, treaties are not eternal. That's the irony of the Eternal Peace Treaty of 1686. From 1686 until 1772, Russia grew stronger and Poland grew weaker, to the point that it could effectively liberally partition and seize control of the territory post 1772. So like I said, it's the delusion, the idea that Ukraine can effectively be stated in a treaty never to become part of NATO is, you can say, as fictional as the idea of an eternal peace treaty, as was ostensibly concluded in 1686. Now, everyone come back to reality, please. The eccentric tripper. So if the partition happens and Ukraine survives as this ferociously anti-Russian nation, will a post-Putin Russia be able to hang together, or will more sub-nationalities try to follow suit? Will a post-Putin Russia... Well, like I said, if the West was able to create Ukraine as an anti-Russian nation, i.e. an ethnic and ideological antithesis, and I mean ethnic in terms of the ethnic self-perception and self-categorization, or in terms of actual ethnography, if the West was able to conclude that, then it would have to be a militarized, powerful Ukraine with extended boundaries. If that could have been achieved, then yes, I believe it could have resulted in a potential crisis of the sub-nationalities in Russia, which is exactly what neoconservatives like Victoria Nuland wanted, and people who fetishize the idea of dismembering Russia. And like I said, I go back to my example of Ivan Mazepa and of Carolus Rex. But they failed. So what effectively could have become Russia's tragedy has been relegated to a Ukrainian tragedy. And it is a tragedy. You know, it makes the commentary on the issue of Ukraine, especially in this country, makes me livid, absolutely livid, because all of these people have effectively been apologists for mass slaughter, unnecessary slaughter. You know, it makes me ashamed, effectively, to be in any way associated by nationality to the common terrier to my country. Thoroughly disgusting. Right. Before I get too angry, because that's the end of the super chats, I think I'm going to leave it there. There is one last super chat. The Bosman. Do you really see Trump pulling a reverse Sino-Soviet split? Or are we too deep for a diplomatic reversal? Trump will not pull a Sino-Soviet split. This isn't Nixon in China, except Trump in Russia. Because Russia and China just have too much invested in one another. Their relationship just makes too much sense. They have a vast land border, which makes sense to be, you know, demilitarized. Russia has resources and China has industry. Russia has the infrastructure capable of linking China economically with Europe and Central Asia and allowing China to exert influence in the Middle East. It just makes too much sense. You know, when we look at Nixon and China in the 1970s and the Sino-Soviet split, one of the reasons that Mao ushered in the Sino-Soviet split, barring the purported ideological reasons, is that he believed he wasn't getting enough from the Soviet Union. So the whole Khrushchev thaw was used as a pretext, effectively, to establish a Chinese sphere of influence vis-a-vis the Russians. The Gunslinger for $2. The commentariat across the West is just poison, yes. Absolutely. All right, everyone. Good night. Let me just get the video ready.